Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor at Urban Village Church, Chicago. My guest this week is the founder of the Chicago Eco House, Keelan Blackwell. I read an article about Keelan in the Chicago Tribune in early November and was moved by his dedication to using sustainability to alleviate poverty, his commitment to the South and West Sides of Chicago, and his passion for integrating his faith into all of his work. I hope you enjoy it. Keelan Blackwell, thank you so much for being part of the Failing Boldly podcast.
Oh yeah, definitely. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the Chicago Eco House, but first let me ask you about you and a little bit of your story and how you came to start this ministry.
Yeah, so I'm originally from Madison, Wisconsin, born and raised. I didn't grow up Christian, so, you know, like I would say for the, you know, most of my childhood, I was like indifferent to sort of having more adversarial relationship with the church. You know, like missionaries would come by, knock on the door, and I'll be a quick to slam in their face kind of thing. So, you know, it really wasn't until I was 18 and I was like a freshman in college, I came to, you know, faith and began to follow Jesus. But, you know, my thing was, if I'm going to follow Jesus, that he's going to have to sort of show himself real to me, because like one of my biggest issues was that, you know, I sort of felt like the church is, you know, largely filled with hypocrites and, you know, is pretty impotent in terms of like, you know, the power and works that, you know, they claim that they care about, but you rarely see. So I would say like that initial sort of experience has really defined my relationship with Christ to this day. That's really more of, you know, me walking with him, following him, but him sort of using his power and love to really demonstrate that he's real and tangible in very concrete ways.
So then you, how did you end up in Chicago?
Yeah, so like I went to the Peace Corps. Okay. So I was in Thailand for a couple years and I got out in 2009. And, you know, after the Peace Corps, I was like, you know, trying to find my way. You know, I was like 24, 25 years old at the time. You know, so like I was working as a community organizer in suburban Milwaukee. And, you know, then I was like kind of just doing some odd jobs while I figured it out. I was like living with my parents, that kind of thing. But, you know, one day I just sort of felt, you know, I believe this is like October 2010, 2009-ish. I just sort of felt like there's gotta be more to life than this. Right. So, you know, I mean, my life is good, but I felt like my life was getting kind of complacent. I just sort of felt myself beginning to, you know, maybe like die and rot from the inside, even though everything on the outside looked good. So my prayer at that time was, you know what, God, I don't care what I have to do. I just want to be on the front lines of whatever you're doing on the earth. You know, I just want to be where the action is. And that one prayer really sort of set off a series of events that, you know, then led to him like really, you know, putting Chicago on my heart. So in like 2011, you know, he really began to, you know, really shut down a lot of things that are going on in Madison, making my life very, very uncomfortable. And, you know, it was like July 1st, 2011 was when he said to me like, hey, like, it's like do or die, right? Like either you're going to do this or you're not going to do this. So, you know, I quit my job and I moved down here. I went to ministry school out in Forest Park. And, you know, it was tough living. I mean, you know, when you don't have a job, I'm not from Chicago. I don't have any friends or family here. So, you know, like I was literally just leaning on God each and every day. I mean, for the basics, like, you know, where I was going to live, food, clothing, shoes, you name it. So it was pretty rough my first few years here in Chicago. But yeah, that's like, you know, why I came here. But like the, you know, the positive side of it is I really felt like God was like telling me that like, this is your Chicanan, you know, it may not look like it right now, but you know, I'm going to make this place your Canaan. And you know, I just really kept that, you know, sort of, you know, word of faith, you know, through a lot of the tough days. And you know, that really has propelled me to like, you know, where we are today.
Do you have a sense of, so you said earlier that you sensed that God was planting the seed of Chicago. Did you have any connection with Chicago before or any sense why?
I did not want to be here.
As you reflect back on it, do you have any sense like why Chicago or just?
Oh, I mean, looking back, yes. Yeah. Okay. So I think like, you know, there's a couple of reasons, you know, why I think God put Chicago, you know, on my heart. Firstly, it's a very strategic city. You know, I think like God has a really big interest, you know, in terms of, you know, trying to redeem society, redeem the United States, and, you know, really try to like close that gap between like where we currently are as a culture and society and, you know, having it reflect a little bit more with like his original intent and his original glory that we sort of see in the book of Genesis. And, you know, when you start thinking about how you do it strategically, there's really only a handful of cities that really, you know, tend to like, you know, dictate the larger culture. So I would say like New York, Chicago, LA, places like that, right? And then, of course, you know, being African American, there's also like a little bit of my personal narrative involved in that. So like my dad grew up in the inner city of Milwaukee, you know, during the 60s. My mom's father, my grandfather, is a sharecropper down in Arkansas. You know, he came up to Milwaukee as part of like that, you know, second great migration, you know, in seek of like jobs, you know, more industrial blue collar jobs. So my mom, you know, and dad met in Milwaukee. But, you know, like the 60s and 70s are like a really rough time, you know, especially if you're black in Milwaukee, you know, busing and a lot of the other sort of post-civil rights, you know, forced integration stuff. So they decided to relocate to Madison so that their kids, you know, me, could have like a better life, right? So, you know, their whole thing was we want to get away from, you know, a lot of the trauma and stuff that we experienced in Milwaukee. And, you know, let's try to give our kids like a really solid foundation, which they did. So in a way, you know, God calling me back to Chicago. And particularly to the inner city, you know, like I live in Inglewood, I'm on the south side, a lot of our work is based, you know, on the south and west side of Chicago. You know, it's more of like a generational coming back home story, right? You know, so I was able to sort of grow up away from a lot of this trauma and problems that, you know, a lot of African Americans experience in Chicago, you know, every day. And that, you know, my grandfather had to deal with, and my parents had to deal with. I had a pretty charmed upbringing. You know, I like to tell people like I had, it was like very Bill Cosby in terms of the way I grew up. It was, you know, upper middle class black, didn't want for anything, went to the best schools, had the best opportunities to excel. And a lot of people in my shoes, you know, definitely would have took those opportunities and then, you know, basically just try to make the best life for you and your own, right? So I don't have to be here. You know, I'm here because I want to be here. You know, so I think like, you know, God sort of saw that, you know, because of like the strategic importance of, you know, Chicago within, you know, sort of shaping U.S. culture, but also sort of my own personal story that, you know, even though I didn't grow up here, you know, like I'm not disconnected from the plight of the people here. And, you know, I'm able to come in, you know, to a place like Inglewood and have like a fresh, you know, sense of perspective because I, you know, fortunately for me, like I wasn't burdened by a lot of the trauma, right? So there's a lot of people, you know, who I, you know, who are my neighbors, who are my friends, who grew up here and, you know, they've had a lot of bad experiences. So it's a little bit harder, you know, to want to like stay in a place of so much pain. But, you know, I really believe that God's, you know, has plans for the inner city, not just to, you know, really, you know, bring wealth and prosperity to, you know, the, to like, you know, historically marginalized groups such as African Americans, but to really use as an example that he can really take the least of these, take, you know, a group of people who in many ways have been the most oppressed in the United States and, you know, really have us be the forefront in terms of, you know, showing the rest of the country what he wants to do for everyone in the nation. And, you know, it's kind of like what it says in the Bible, right? You know, like, you know, so that no man will boast before him, right? So like, you know, he'll take the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. So I really look at it as like, you know, a lot of the people that we're working with are essentially people who have been counted out, you know, like we work with like a lot of gang affiliated young adults. We work with like a lot of young adults who've been homeless, right? These are people who, you know, society will look at and be like, you know, we don't expect anything from you. You have nothing to contribute. But God doesn't see that. So I think when, you know, God begins to use something like Eco House to really elevate these people and elevate their stories and really, you know, untap the potential that they have, it's humbling for everybody that like, yes, at the end of the day, I don't care what your background is. I don't care what your race is. I don't care, you know, like how much money you have in the bank account. No one's going to boast before God. Right. So that's where I think the value of doing this in a place like Chicago is.
Yeah. So tell me first, tell me about Eco House and what it is. And then I'm going to back up a little bit and ask you how it came to be.
Yeah, so Chicago Eco House is a 501c3 nonprofit. We're not a religious nonprofit. We have the mission of using sustainability to alleviate inner city poverty. And we do that by taking over vacant lots on the south and west sides of Chicago and converting them into off-grid flower farms. So we're the only urban ag outfit in the city of Chicago that uses solar power rainwater irrigation systems. So we have like tanks on our site for rainwater collection that we then use to irrigate, you know, our flowers. And we do run it as a commercial enterprise. So we're a fully vertically integrated farmer florist. So, you know, anything that you can get at your local florist, we can do for you as well. Mm. So, you know, the whole point is really to try to achieve a couple of goals. Number one is job creation for a lot of the at-risk youth in these communities. The second goal is urban blight reduction, you know, really taking over blighted spaces and turning them into productive assets within the community. And the third goal is really advancing sustainability, right? So, you know, agriculture in general can be a very, you know, water and energy intensive endeavor. You know, so when we're using renewable energy instead of like, you know, leaning on ComEd to provide our power, or we're using like rainwater collection versus like using water from the city of Chicago, which is ultimately coming from Lake Michigan. It's just ways to, you know, be able to be a lot more sustainable with our agricultural practices. So I really like to say that, you know, we like to focus on, you know, trying to restore a relationship with, you know, God, between like, you know, the people are working with, and trying to like have them reconnect with God in a way that is more meaningful and tangible, you know, restoring our relationship with each other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, love, you know, your neighbor as yourself, but then also restoring that relationship with creation, which I think is like often neglected. And, you know, really it's the creation piece that is making a lot of the, you know, provision and abundance possible. So it's really like sort of hitting those three goals.
Yeah. So then, was it your background in the Peace Corps that made you think about something like Eco House, or what were the seeds that were planted earlier in your life that made you feel like this is the thing that I want to create?
Yeah, Peace Corps, I would say, was the beginning of it. Okay. So yeah, like being in Thailand, that was like my first time in a farming context, you know, whatsoever. And like one of my projects on Peace Corps was like working with local farmers to help them form a organic fertilizer co-op. So, you know, that was like the first time I began to like think about it, and maybe gain a little bit more of appreciation for a more rural, you know, lifestyle. Because, you know, growing up in a city, we tend to look down on, you know, rural communities and people, just being honest, you know. But, you know, I think like I began to see like a simplicity with that way of life. You know, like I began to have more respect for, you know, sort of like living off the earth and that kind of thing. And then, you know, once I got out of the Peace Corps, I think the, you know, when I was like looking for a job, I sort of stumbled into biodiesel. So, you know, like I worked, you know, collecting used cooking oil for a biodiesel refinery in Milwaukee at the time. It was called, Fusion Renewables. And that really just sort of like whet my appetite for sustainability, it just in general, because I think like, you know, one of the things that was, a turnoff for me when it comes to environmentalism was that it's, you know, like a lot of the conversation is centered around sort of policy and, you know, really trying to take more like civic action. And of course, like, you know, I always cared about sort of having clean air and that kind of stuff, and it's very important. But I never really thought that, you know, being environmentally friendly could also be good business, you know, and that can also be profitable. So I think like my experiences in Peace Corps just gave me a general appreciation for creation and for the nature and for like a, you know, a simpler way of living. But I think when I was working in the biodiesel industry, you know, I gained a, you know, a understanding that, hey, this can actually make money. This can actually create jobs. Like, you know, when you work with creation, it's not only good stewardship, but it's also good, you know, economics.
I'm curious about people's response to Eco House today and then when you first started, because I can see a couple things. One, when people think about something that you've done, I would imagine a lot of people think, oh, this must be something in Portland, Oregon, or this must be something in, you know, in the midst of the Appalachia, right, or something like that.
Right.
And then at the flip side, you mentioned a little bit earlier that there might be some mistrust of people in an urban setting of agriculture.
Right.
And so were both of those barriers when you were first trying to start this?
Well, the biggest difference today, I get fan mail. So, okay, you know, that's
and a new... it wasn't always that the case?
No. So, you know, when we were starting out, so originally when we started in 2014, like we were thinking it was going to be more of like a transitional housing setup, you know, where we get a house and we'll do some green stuff around the house. But, you know, for the most part, it looked like transitional housing, okay, right? But then once we like started moving towards ag, we first had like more of a conventional, you know, school garden. Like, you know, our first garden was at Tim Ingwood High School in Inglewood. And, you know, like it was cool, you know, it was nice, but, you know, it didn't really necessarily have the same impact that we were hoping, you know, because we kind of discovered that it can be a little difficult to sell food, you know, particularly like when you don't got the resources to, you know, be able to abide by like the USDA guidelines and that kind of thing. So then we started looking at flowers, and I would say like initially we faced a lot of blowback from that, particularly within the community.
Within the community of Inglewood. People who live in Inglewood, okay.
Yeah. You know, because people are like, well, you can't eat a flower, so like, why are you wasting your time? You know what I mean? So like, I think a lot of people initially didn't understand like why we were doing that, you know, that it just sort of felt like this, you know, kind of uppity project, you know, like people out here are starving and you're just trying to grow these flowers that serve no purpose, right? But, you know, for us, the only reason we decided to focus on flowers is because we were looking at it purely as a cash crop. So we were looking more at the economic side of it, because you know about 80% of the flowers that you see in the United States are imports from places like Central and South America, Holland, that kind of thing. So there's actually a lot of opportunity, you know, to grow flowers and sell them domestically, particularly when you live in a place like Chicago, which has like a huge market, you know, just from a consumption standpoint. So you know now, you know that people have kind of seen, you know, the light, if you will, of, you know, growing flowers. Yeah, you know, now I get fan mail. Now people appreciate it, you know. People see that's creating jobs. People see that's generating income. And in a lot of ways, you know, people see that it's more empowering than, you know, just your traditional conventional food enterprise. And, you know, we're not like knocking food. I mean, one day we'd like to get into food ourselves.
Yeah.
But it's just like from an economic standpoint, there's just a lot more money in flowers than food at this standpoint, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like it definitely took a lot of faith, you know, because like flowers ultimately, from my perspective, was really God's idea. You know, I mean, I wish I could take credit for it, but I didn't wake up thinking, oh, I want to be a flower man. You know, like that was something that God's vision for the neighborhood. And it's kind of funny you mentioned like Portland. My wife's family's lives in Portland.
Oh, really?
And I actually just got back there from, you know, Thanksgiving and stuff. So, you know, ain't gonna lie, Portland's not one of my favorite places to be around, you know, particularly as an African American. But, you know, like you're kind of like you're alluding to, you know, there's definitely a very strong environmentalism movement.
Yeah.
And I think like one of the things that's been very interesting is that, you know, when I look at places like Portland or even a place like Madison where I'm from, and you sort of see like, you know, a lot of these greenies who want to kind of come together and congregate, you know, amongst one another. I mean, it's cool, but like overall, they're not necessarily moving the needle, right? Because they're just kind of like going to a place where it's easy to do it. But when you do it in a place like Chicago and you do like, you know, environmentalism in a place like Inglewood where people don't expect it, you know, and you're using it to really solve real and, you know, a lot of people consider like insurmountable problems. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why we get a lot of traction with Eco House is not because we're just growing flowers and we're doing like this cool green thing, right? It's because, you know, we're putting teens to work who normally wouldn't have jobs and who otherwise would be on the streets, you know, like dealing drugs or shooting or that kind of thing, right? You're like solving problems around urban blight, you know, which depresses like the city's tax base, right? You're helping, you know, to divert water runoff, which is a huge problem for like, you know, metropolitan wastewater reclamation district here in the city, you know, in terms of like trying to manage all that rainwater runoff on the streets and that kind of thing. So, you know, it has like all these other like problems that's being solved, which is what people are interested in. And then it's like, oh, and you're green. That's cool. Right. So then it sort of like shapes or reshapes like, you know, the message of like what it means to be sustainable and green. And on top of that, you're really expanding the tent of environmentalism because now you have people, you know, like in a place like Inglewood, you know, who maybe originally wouldn't see themselves as being a part of the sustainability movement because they couldn't see like, well, how does Teslas and solar panels and stuff benefit me? You know, it seems like those are like for white people. That's like very expensive and affluent, you know, but you do a flower farm, you know, with like some simple like totes to collect the water. I mean, to set up a farm for us is like $4,000 to $5,000. Like it's cheap. You know what I mean? You know, so when people see that and they see like the net impact on their community, now all of a sudden we start talking about sustainability, they want to listen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think like there's like a lesson in it, you know, at least from my standpoint that, you know, it's cool to be passionate about, you know, whatever you're passionate about. But, you know, sometimes like maybe instead of like going to where other people are and try to just like congregate and stay in your own silos, like go to a place where it's not being practiced, you know, go to a place where maybe there's a greater need for it, even if it's a lot more difficult because the payoff's going to be a lot bigger down the road. And you're going to end up like moving that needle a lot further than if you were just like hanging around people who are, you know, like you.
Yeah. Did you have, when you first moved into Inglewood, because you were from Madison and spent time in Milwaukee, was there some distrust? Did it take a while for you to begin to be integrated into the neighborhood?
Yeah, so that was very interesting too. So, you know, like I started off like tutoring at Tim Inglewood High School before we even started Eco House, like back in like 2013. And I distinctly remember like working with the teens and the first thing they would say to me is, oh, I didn't know they made black people like you, you know?
And what did they mean by that?
Oh, so, you know, like, basically, like, someone who, you know, was very proper, very clean cut, very straight-laced, you know what I mean? So, I mean, you know, they'll be like, well, we've seen, you know, guys like you on TV, right? But, like, not in their day-to-day, you know what I'm saying? You know, which is a whole nother conversation for another day. But, you know, like, it's just, like, you know, for me, it's just kind of, I was, like, taken back because, you know, I kind of grew up in a world where I was around a lot of very prominent and, you know, well-educated and straight-laced African-Americans. So, you know, I think there was a little bit of, you know, even though we're both African-Americans, I think there's a little bit of like cross-cultural, you know, understanding that we had to bridge, you know, because like, you know, from my standpoint, I was trying to like, you know, adapt to their world because I didn't grow up in the hood. You know what I mean? I didn't necessarily understand the things that a lot of my students were facing day to day. And from their standpoint, you know, they needed to try to adapt to me because like they didn't know that African-Americans could do the things that I was doing. You know what I mean? So in a way, like, you know, there's like a beauty to that. You know, because like, I feel like it helped both of us to really expand our horizons and open our minds. But like in terms of like being able to integrate into the community, I would say I probably had on the cultural side of it a much easier time, you know, because I think there was like, you know, I mean, of course people want to feel you out and they want to like, you know, make sure you're like legit. But I think like there's appreciation that, oh, you know, here's a guy who isn't from here, who obviously, you know, like went to school, did some things, and he's coming back, where most people like me leave and stay out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think like, you know, like initially that was like a big asset in terms of like really trying to like integrate into the neighborhood.
What would you say are, and you may have a good perspective of this, because you're not from Chicago, some of the biggest misconceptions that people have, particularly for people who live on the South and West Side?
You mean misconceptions of outsiders?
Of outsiders, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so, yeah, that's funny. So, I had my as an outsider, former outsider, I think, like, we oversimplify sort of, like, some of the narratives, right? We think that, you know, we look at, like, a teen who's, like, in a gang and we just want to, like, criminalize them. We look at you as, you know, we want to say, oh, you're finally a bad guy. Or we look at these neighborhoods and we think that they're, like, you know, inherently dangerous, right? Like, it's a no-fly zone kind of thing. And I definitely had that mentality. Like, that's why I didn't want to be here. You know, when God was initially telling me, I want you to live in Inglewood, I had to wrestle with that. You know, like, that was not something that was in, you know, my 10-year plan. You know, and initially, like, it did feel uncomfortable, but more because, like, I had those misconceptions, right? You know, but, like, as I've lived here, as I began to work with the people, you know, firstly, I would say, you know, it's no different than any other community. Like, you know, for the most part, it's just people who are just trying to, like, you know, do what anyone else is trying to do. They're trying to, like, you know, make sure their kids can get into the best schools, trying to put food on the table, trying to get the, you know, the best jobs possible, get the best shelter possible. Like, you know, just trying to meet your basic needs just like anybody else in the world, right? The other thing I would say is I feel like, you know, one of the things that, you know, I come to really appreciate is just like the openness of people on the South Side. You know, so before I moved here, I was like on the Northwest Side in Belmont Cragin, like off Belmont and Pulaski. And I would say like on the North Side, people tend to keep more to themselves. You know what I mean? Like it's a lot harder to build relationships with your neighbors, you know, like here on the South Side, like, you know, people just sit on their front porch in the summer and you can go and you can talk to them. You know, so like there's like this accessibility that you have to your neighbor that you don't necessarily have in other parts of the city. And I would say just because of a lot of the external circumstances that people face every day, there's like both the resiliency and a grittiness that people have in these neighborhoods, plus an openness to the new, you know. So I think of something like Eco House, and honestly, if I was like in Lincoln Park or Lakeview, we wouldn't be able to get this off the ground, you know. It'd been too many people trying to shoot it down who had the means to, you know. I mean, when the status quo is working for you, you're not going to, you know, who cares about trying to do like a flower farm on your block, right? You don't need it. But like in a place like Inglewood or in Woodlawn, you know, people are like more open to it. They're like, well, you know what? Nothing else is working. You know, the establishment's failing us. So, hey, let's give it a shot. Let's see if it does work. And even if they're skeptical in the very beginning, like they were, you know, but they're at least willing to give it a try. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I think just from like a spiritual standpoint, it makes it more fertile ground for God to be able to like birth new things in the earth, right? Because there's like that desperation that you need to be able to like try something new. And, you know, if you're talking about really trying to shift culture and shift society and make it reflect more the image of Christ, it's a lot harder to do that in places where, you know, the world's working for you. So, yeah, like that would be sort of my thoughts on, you know, really like the outside perception of it versus being in it for a while and living here. And, you know, honestly, I don't want to be anywhere else. Like, I love being in Inglewood. Absolutely love it. You know, for all its beauty and ashes, wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Yeah. What are, as we start looking at into 2020 and you think about EcoHouse, what are the biggest challenges right now for EcoHouse?
Yeah, definitely growth is okay. Like, we're kind of like in this phase now. So the last few years have definitely been us getting the KingSolver model and, okay. you know, really trying to like perfect a lot of different aspects of our programming, our farm operations, our business model. Now I feel like we're kind of like in a place where we have a lot of that together. So now it's more about just trying to like expand and get a customer base, right? So, you know, one of the biggest things that we're looking to do in 2020 is really, you know, just advertising and PR and just trying to get, you know, our story out there so people know that, hey, you can buy flowers from us, you know, that they're beyond organic compared to like most flowers that you buy that have been sprayed with heavy pesticides and herbicides. It's supporting like job creation, you know, in the inner city. Like, it's a very easy way to express your values that, you know, for someone who's like getting married or having like, you know, Mother's Day and want to give a bouquet. Like, it's very simple, but for us, it's like very meaningful and impactful, right? Because it's like going to support a lot of jobs and entrepreneurial opportunities for people who otherwise wouldn't have it. And then, you know, not even that point, but like, you know, when people buy from us, you're also contributing to like literally rebuilding the city of Chicago. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, kind of like I was alluding to, but like one of the things, you know, sort of got having us take the hard road is now we have a model that is scalable, you know, which most urban farms don't have. You know, so like I was telling you, it costs about like $5,000 to build a farm. So, you know, when you think about a city that has like 30 to 40,000 vacant lots, right? And if you're trying to get to scale, you can't have a very top heavy model. So, you know, we have a very lean and mean model where, you know, every dollar that comes into our organization, you know, has like $3 or $4 of impact, not just in terms of on the people that we're working with, but in terms of like physically reshaping a lot of the urban blight in the community, right? And that's better for everybody. So, yeah, like that's definitely the big thing in 2020. If I can do a little plug.
Please.
www.southsidebloom.com is where you can buy flowers from us.
Do you also sell to florists or do you only sell out of your own with your own business?
Yeah, so we sell direct to consumer.
Okay.
So we are a florist.
Okay.
Yeah, so you know, bouquets, centerpieces, installations, you name it, we'll do it.
All right.
So, yes, please consider us before you buy your flowers.
What keeps you going? You talked earlier about the notion of grittiness and resilience in folks who live in Englewood. How about for you on those days when I would imagine you have days where you're a little bit anxious about the potential of growth and what's going to happen. What keeps you going?
Yeah, so I would say in the beginning, by the beginning, I mean like when I first started this journey in like 2011, this really bothered me a lot more. Like I was like overwhelmed. I would have like nights where, you know, I couldn't sleep just because anxiety would like grip me so bad. But like nowadays, it's kind of become normal. You know, it's like my new normal. And I think a lot of it is just, I had to like really get to a place where, you know, a lot of these, the things, if you will, like the, you know, the promises of God wasn't like the most important thing, right? So once, you know, I would say like, you know, by 2013, 2014, after really taking my lumps and, you know, really learning the hard way of, you know, what this walk was really about, you know, I really began to just reshape and refocus and reframe it as like, hey, this is really just a day-to-day journey with God, right? And regardless of what happens, like the outcomes don't really matter as much. You know what I'm saying? And I think like that was what was really driving a lot of my anxiety was I sort of felt like this pressure to be a success. You know, I felt like this pressure to sort of show people that, yes, like God told me to do this. And, you know, like I'm not like a failure. And, you know, I can hear God and see, look, like we're doing these great works. And once like that was removed, because like a lot of that was coming out of this need to really feel like I'm being affirmed by man, right? Being affirmed by people. And you know, once God really broke that in me, you know, that's when I became like a totally different person, you know, like, so even like now, if, you know, EcoHouse were to quote unquote fail and we were to lose everything that we have, you know, no biggie, you know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, it's not about that. You know, it's really just about that personal relationship that I have with Jesus and just the honor of like being a part of this pilgrimage, you know, like I like how like, you know, Jacob in the Bible talks about it, you know, like it was like his pilgrimage is like his journey, right? Because he had all sorts of ups and downs. He had a lot of big wins and big losses. But the thing that really kept him was like that faithfulness with God, right? And then you really just begin to like see sort of like, you know, the different aspects of God and his character as you go through different situations. And he begins to show you things about yourself that you didn't even know you had, right? I mean, like me, for example, I never thought I'd be into flowers, right? This is something that he showed me, and I'm like, and you know, eternally grateful for those kind of things. So if I never really just embraced the process, you know, like I wouldn't be where I wouldn't be at where I'm at right now, you know? So like definitely sort of getting out of this mindset where it's about the results, it's about the outcomes, it's about feeling like I need to be affirmed by someone, you know, to sort of feel like my faith is sort of somehow being validated. You know, in full disclosure, there was a time where I was in the prosperity gospel movement. And, you know, like one of the things about prosperity gospel is like, it's, you know, it's really about like, hey, you know, if your faith is working, you can get a new car, you can get a new house, you can get this. It's like, you know, all the stuff, right, to really validate who you are as a Christian. And like a lot of that was like, you know, sewed into me. And God really had to like go through a process to really like, you know, rework and rewire it of like, hey, look at like, yes, I'm for you having prosperity, but like that's not the end goal. Right. There's going to be days where, you know, you may have nothing. You may have very little. Mm-hmm. There's maybe days you may have a lot, kind of like how Paul talks about. But, you know, through it all, like you've really learned to see God's faithfulness to be able to sustain you through it, you know. And that's what I had to learn. I had to learn like, OK, when I have nothing, you know, like there's a time, once again, full disclosure, where I was homeless, you know. Where I was like kind of like just going from couch to couch. I had to like live out of my car for a little bit, you know. And when you come from a place of you know, affluence and, you know, a lot of opportunity, it's very, very humiliating. You know what I mean?
And your family too. I would imagine your family is saying, Keelan, what are you doing?
more than you would know.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. They did not understand. Even to this day, they don't really understand, you know? So I'm dealing with that too, right? Because it's like, you know, everyone's got like the expectations of their parents. And that was like one of the things I had to get beyond. Like, hey, you know what? Like, yeah, I love my parents, but, you know, they don't define who I am and they don't define my relationship with God. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, there was like a lot of, hey, you know, you went to college, you got a master's, you did this. Why are you living in Inglewood? Why are you in the hood? Why are you like, you know, like you're squandering it, right? And that was like, I would say even like to this day, I would say there's a lot of people who still don't even understand my lifestyle, but I really don't care. You know what I'm saying? Just because like I've seen God, you know, keep me through a lot of these like tough times and, you know, to really go from a place where like, you know, back in 2013, you know, you're sleeping in your Jeep to like now where, you know, you got, you know, heck, people like you coming in and wanting to interview me and wanting to share my story and share my testimony and to just see like, you know, how God has really took me from a place of, you know, ridicule and shame to a place of honor in, you know, 6 years. I mean, that's Jesus. You know what I'm saying? And he can turn anyone's life around like that. I mean, like I was talking to one of my friends and, you know, she was just saying like, oh man, Keelan, I'm so envious of your life. You know, you got great kids. Your wife makes you home cooked meals every day. You don't have to like do these long commutes. You're not stuck in traffic. And I told her, I was like, look it, you know, we both serve the same God, you know? So I don't want you to like look at my life and say, hey, I'm envious of you. No, like use that as an example to inspire you of what God could do through you. You know what I mean? And like even for your listeners, like we all serve the same God. This is all possible for everyone who's, you know, listening and who like declares Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. I think, you know, that the hard part is like sort of deciding, are you going to take that straight and narrow road, you know, versus like the broad and wide road that leads to destruction. You know what I mean? Because like, yeah, it's going to feel tough in the very beginning and you're going to have to be willing to let go of a lot of things that you maybe are holding on, you know, dear to, whether it's your status, your money, your degrees. And you have to be willing to be like, hey, you know what? Like for me, if I have to live out my Jeep for the rest of my life, but I know God's with me, I'm okay with that. Like I had to get to that place. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying it's easy. Like, yeah. I've been there.
I always end these conversations by asking someone to share a story of failure from their own life. So this can be either personal, professional, something that happened yesterday or a few years ago. So I was wondering if you could share a story from your own life.
Yeah, I do have a story. You know, so, you know, once again, full disclosure, you know, you did ask me this prior to us being on the air. So I took some time to think about it and pray about it. So, you know, the story that I want to share, I want to sort of share in the context of John chapter 12, verses 23 to 25, which says, Jesus replied, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it remains only a single seed. But if it dies, it produces many seeds. The man who loves his life will lose it, while the man who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." So, you know, when you're in farming, like I am, you know, a lot of these parables that Jesus will share you know, begin to make a little more sense to you. So in farming, there's this concept called cover cropping. I don't know if you're familiar with. Okay, so cover cropping is basically a crop that you plant with the ideal that, you know, increase soil fertility, right? Yeah. So it could be something like buckwheat. It could be something like clover. But, you know, like that basically, you know, like it will take a lot of the sun. It'll convert a lot of that sunlight into nutrients in its root system, make the soil more fertile. So then when you plant your cash crop, it will grow and be a lot more bountiful, right? So I like to look at failure, I put this in quotes, failure, when you're like doing it sort of from a Christ-centered perspective, similar to cover cropping, right? Where God will like lead you to do something where it looks like it's, you know, something that's going to fail, but really the intention is for it to die so that you can have more life and abundance for your cash crop, right? So for me, back in, you know, 2011, 2012, the thing that God was telling me to do was to start this medical supplies business, right? And, you know, like most people, you know, the moment God tells you something, you just run for the gates, right? You're like, I heard the voice of God. I'm going to start this medical supplies business. Then you start like getting ahead of yourself. Your imagination starts imagining the riches and the, you know, all this other stuff that's going to come because God told you you're going to do this business, right? You know, so I'm like working my butt off, trying to like get this business off the ground. And at first, like I see a little growth, you know, like we're able to get into a nice office, we're able to get some clients. I'm thinking, okay, we're on our way, right? And then all of a sudden come like, you know, mid 2012, you know, the wheels fall off, right? Like, you know, I start having some issues with my business partners. You know, we lose some clients, you know, we're go from being in the black to being in the red. And I'm thinking to myself, like, God, what is going on? You know? And, you know, like once again, like I'm at like our office was in a church. So, you know, all of this drama is being played out before my brothers and sisters in Christ, you know? So I kind of go from sort of being like, oh, you know, there's Keelan who's like, you know, doing these cool things. He's definitely going to be a success to, oh, wow. Like, you know, this thing's really blowing up. I guess his faith isn't working, you know? And I'm like feeling like all this pain and embarrassment, you know? So, you know, the business fails, like come September, you know, 2012, I get kicked out of that office. Like it's really, really, it's a big embarrassment. Like one of my most embarrassing, humbling moments of my life, right? And, you know, I basically just kind of felt like I was, you know, thrown on the trash heap, you know? Like, it's kind of funny because, you know, when like those kind of situations happen, particularly in like a Christian setting, you would think people would reach out and check in on you. Nope, not for me. You know, it's like, you know, it's just like, you know, me just kind of like sitting there by myself with God, you know? And like, I spent the next few months literally just licking my wounds and being like, well, what happened, right? You know, God, I was sure you told me to do this, you know? So why did it fail? And why did it fail so big? And, you know, I look at like this verse, you know, where it says, you know, in 23 that, you know, I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat falls to the ground and dies, it certainly only will be a single seed, but if it dies, it'll produce many seeds. You know, it's like God was intentionally leading me to a death so that it will produce much fruit later, right? Which came in the form of Eco House. Because like, you know, I learned a lot of lessons sort of in the death of that previous business, and that put me on the path towards what I'm doing today. Yeah. So, you know, at the time, I didn't realize it, but that was really what God was asking me to do was my cover crop. You know what I'm saying? It was something that he knew was going to die. It wasn't going to be the cash crop, right? But it was going to set up my cash crop for greater success, which later became Eco House. You know, so, and, you know, once again, full disclosure, I've had, that's one of many failure stories I've had. You can have more than one cover crop. I'll throw that out there right now. You know, but like, you know, to encourage people, sure. You know, like, because there's a lot of times where you feel like, well, I'm pretty sure God told me this, and then it feels like it didn't work out. And then you start, you know, having that crisis of faith. And, you know, and I think a lot of it is, you know, kind of like that disconnect with creation. Like, we don't understand creation. We don't understand agriculture. We don't understand reaping and sowing, you know, and like being in ag, it's like, oh, now I totally get it. Now I see that God wasn't doing that to hurt me. He was doing that to help me. And now I like look back and I'm like, you know what, God? Thank you for letting that thing die because I would have missed out on all these other things. And then I look at the people who are being helped by Eco House or being inspired by Eco House. And I think to myself, man, like, what if in that moment I quit? You know, because like a lot of people do. You know, the moment something doesn't work out and your expectations aren't met, you quit. You know, and I think about like not just about how my life would have turned out, but like all the people who are now benefiting from Eco House, right? Even people who are just listening to the story may never even step foot on our farms, but they're hearing this testimony, right? Like you're benefiting from this. And none of this would be possible if I would have quit that day, yeah. You know? So that's a big thing I want to encourage, like, you know, your listeners and other people. Do not quit, even if you do not understand. You know, it's about finishing your race.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me in 2019, yes, I can look back. It makes a little more sense. But in the moment, when it doesn't make sense, it feels like you're in this massive warfare. It feels like there's a lot of confusion. You know, like, that's where the enemy or has you at your most vulnerable moment. You know what I'm saying? And that's where I feel like, you know, that's where your true mettle as a Christian is going to, you know, show and be displayed. So do not quit.
Good. Well, I'm glad you didn't quit. SaucyBlooms.com is the website. And then EcoHouse also has its own website too, correct?
Yep. People learn ChicagoEcoHouse.org. Yep.
Okay, great. Good. Well, Keelan Blackwell, thank you so much for sharing part of your story with me today.
Oh, definitely. Thanks, Christian. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it.
That's this week's episode. Thanks again to Keelan for giving his time for this conversation. To learn more about Chicago Eco House, again, you can go to ChicagoEcoHouse.org or to the Chicago Eco House Facebook page. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to ChristianKuhn.com. Please consider subscribing to this podcast via Apple Podcasts or Spotify. My next conversation is with Susanna Cass, an Australian mom who created a new board game for kids called the Epic Fail Game. Thanks again for listening.